This is an ABC podcast.
Ayla Lapine writes, "Architecture doesn't teach us what the sacred is, but architecture may touch the sacred and draw others to it. Architecture interprets holiness and offers it to the people. And in that sense, perhaps architects have the capacity to be priests, designing spaces that call for a meeting between earth and heaven."
I had no idea that this was going to be my direction of travel. And yet, the buildings that I was in made me hungry. They really made me hungry spiritually and also made me hungry aesthetically. I drank them in.
Hello, I'm Meredith Lake, with you for Soul Search. Have you found yourself in a place like that, where heaven and earth seem to meet? What was it, what is it, that makes a building sacred? A bit later on, we're going to hear how the Baha'i community are answering that question. But first, I want you to meet Ayla, who's been exploring sacred space for years. Ayla is an art historian currently based at the National Gallery in London, and I asked her just to begin opening up this whole idea of sacred architecture.
I think there are a couple things I'd like to say just to set the stage for people. One is that you never know when some kind of experience of the numinous, whatever that might mean for you, will take place. And it's not necessarily something you can kind of force to happen. I sometimes describe it to people like trying to fall asleep. You know, you can't necessarily do that. But to just be open. And there is a long, long tradition, not only in Christianity, but in many different world faiths, of the whole of creation being sacred space. And sometimes God is spoken of as a kind of divine architect. So in that sense, the whole of creation, what Christianity in our creed would say visible and invisible, is a sacred zone where you never know what that experience of holiness might look like or where it might be. Sacred architecture is a particular set of spaces, the built environment, where you've got a purpose that is set apart. And it's the purpose of worship. So if we have a little bit of a working definition for what sacred architecture is, we would say it's a place of worship. There are plenty of churches as communities that will meet in movie theaters or in school halls or outside in parks. And all of those things are great. You know, the community is the body of Christ gathered together. But for me, there is something not just special, but also really genuinely essential about sacred spaces that have been crafted specifically for worship and for the glorification of God in the best way possible, whatever that way was at the time.
Ayla, you've already begun to open up some of the things I wanted to discuss with you. The experience of a person in a place, an experience of the numinous, I think you said, the purpose perhaps of an individual or a community in terms of worship. And in a sense, it leaves me with the question of, well, can any space or building be sacred? Or are there limits to the idea of sacred architecture?
That's a wonderful question. Right now, as I'm speaking to you, I am in a basement meeting room at the National Gallery in London, where I work. And I have no doubt whatsoever that this place and so many museums around the world is a kind of sacred space for people. People come here searching for something. They may have a deep sense of spiritual, faithful hope that they may encounter something that might be deeply moving for them. And I also know that visitors here, they do pray with the paintings. So in the Sainsbury Wing, which has a lot of altarpieces, especially from Italy before the 1500s, people will go and they'll just spend a long time there. And you might think that they are merely looking, if I can call it that. But for sure, for many people, it is not just a sacred encounter, but it's a devotional encounter. And one of my favorite things about the Sainsbury Wing, which is by the architectural firm Venturi Scott Brown, it's from the early 1990s, is that they have this little chapel-like space just to the right of the first room. So just as you enter, there are these two little doors. Architecturally, it's quite subtle, but it tends to be for displaying works of sacred art that really invite a kind of contemplative experience and indeed a kind of devotional experience. And there's a little bench so people can sit down. And at the moment, there is a stunning Fra Angelico painting of Christ's resurrection and majesty in heaven surrounded by innumerable saints. And it is absolutely a holy encounter and not just for me. And then when I think about the importance of sacred architecture, which is set apart for the purpose of worship, I think about St. Martin in the Fields, which is just next door to the National Gallery. Hmm. It takes the form, like so many churches do, of a neoclassical building. So it's inspired by Greco-Roman antiquity. And stepping into that space, you can see an altar, a flickering candle where the sacrament is reserved, where the consecrated bread, which becomes the body of Christ, is kept. And that space is really big and really famous. So people come in for concerts all the time. It's got a massive homelessness ministry. It does a lot of work with refugees and asylum seekers. And I'm very proud to be in association with them as a partner. And I often think of people going to concerts in that space and wondering what they make of being in a place that has an altar and that has this window and that has the sacrament reserved. So it's not just that churches and cathedrals are active as sacred spaces on a Sunday, and it's not just that museums are so-called secular places where people encounter art and appreciate it, but it doesn't touch them in a way which is not just empathetic, but devotional and numinous.
What you're drawing out here is the potential, at least, for distinctions to be made between sacred spaces and ostensibly religious spaces. Because, I think the role of the gallery, the modern gallery, I think is a really interesting example of what some people might consider the transference of sacredness from, you know, the more traditionally religious space into an ostensibly secular one, although I take your point that galleries, you know, that's being too narrow, I think, in estimating what galleries can be and mean to people. Mm. But just listening to you, Ayla, I do wonder if, apart from the use of the space, whether it needs to be beautiful in some sense. I mean, what does beauty have to do with the potential, or maximizing the potential, if you like, of a space or a building to have that transformative sacred quality?
Oh, wow. The first thing I thought of was Thomas Aquinas in his Summa, which is this vast, vast text, highly systematized. And he was thinking in all sorts of different ways about the doctrine of God and how to explore what it is to be a Christian from his own scholastic medieval point of view. And he talks about what beauty is in his own divine Christian context. And more or less, he defines it as something which pleases when seen. So he's thinking about the relationship between beauty and pleasure and a sensory kind of, specifically visual, encounter with Christian understanding. And understanding is tricky because it's like, to what extent do we understand? What's the relationship between language and image? So I've always loved that little mini definition from Aquinas because it sounds simple, a bit like love is all you need or love your neighbor as yourself, but it contains multitudes, because when you start to put it into practice or when you start to imagine it, you think, oh, wow, what does that mean? What is the relationship between pleasure and being human and worshiping God? And what does, exactly as you said, that have to do with beauty and sacred space? So you can find beauty anywhere. And one of my very favorite philosophers on this is someone called Elaine Scarry, who wrote a book called On Beauty and Being Just, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful little book. And one of the things that I love about what she has to say is that when we encounter beauty, we desire it. And sometimes we want to possess it, but more often than not, we want to share it. And so there's something kind of evangelical, missional, even, as some of my colleagues would say, about beauty. So you can go into the zone of art for art's sake, as a lot of people did, again, in the late 19th century with the aesthetic movement. And as we see all the time, where beauty and morality don't have to be linked together. But in the case of a sacred space, the relationship between beauty and, let's say, ethics more broadly within a religious context are totally linked together. At least that's what I believe.
I'm speaking with Ayla Lapine, the Amundsen Fellow in Religion and Art at the National Gallery in London, about what it is exactly that makes a space sacred. I'm fascinated by this idea that beauty really matters, perhaps because beauty makes us catch our breath and cede our ground to the thing that stands before us. That was philosopher Elaine Scarry's big insight, that beauty is decentering, and in that way, beauty's linked to virtue, even justice. Now, I'm sure Ayla could take us further down the rabbit hole of the philosophy of aesthetics, but to stay with architecture here on Soul Search, with the buildings that some people experience as sacred, I think we need to talk about the less than beautiful associations that we can have with churches. Even the most stunning basilicas and cathedrals aren't straightforwardly beautiful to all of us. They might remind us of a faith that we've lost, or the failures and complicities of the institution. Ayla grapples with this not only as a scholar of sacred space, she's also an ordained Anglican priest preparing to work in a London parish.
One of the reasons why the church as an institution is so difficult for people across a variety of different denominations, and there's lots that we could say, and I'm aware that this is a podcast about sacred architecture, not so much about that, but I just want to say this one thing. I remember when I was teaching at the University of Essex in the School of Philosophy and Art History. It's a modern university. It's got an incredible, incredible department. I loved being there. And I remember one of my colleagues coming up to me when I said that I was going to leave to train to become a priest. Someone came up to me and said, okay, so I hear that you're going to go and become a priest, and that's all very nice, but why would you give yourself over in that way to a sexist, racist, homophobic institution? Why would you do that?
And
I think a lot of the time when, I'm going to explain. And I think a lot of time when people choose not to go into a church or a cathedral, even though it's an incredibly, you know, beautiful space, or even though there's lots to learn or lots to explore, regardless of whether they're from any faith or none, they associate those places with places of oppression, injustice, colonial destructiveness and violence. They associate those places with those terrible atrocities. And rightly so, unfortunately. There's a much bigger story to tell, but that story is true. And to deny it is just a bad idea and would also be unjust in itself. And so I spoke to that person, and I've had plenty of conversations like that since. When I spoke to that person, I said that it's really important to me to respond to what I think God is asking me to do. And it's not necessarily going to be comfortable as a queer feminist woman. It's not necessarily going to be the best experience, but it's something where I hope that in what I can articulate, as well as what I can offer as best I can alongside a community, I can speak into that problem as well and not be an apologist for it and say, yes, this is absolutely terrible. And it's about being on the inside, agitating for change. And sometimes that's kind of how it needs to be for one reason or another, while also being thankful for those who are on the outside agitating for change. And yet it also breaks my heart because there are, thank God, a number of people who are really celebrating the beauty of those traditions and who are in some of these incredibly important and glorious sacred spaces, who are yearning for the day when a beautiful trans couple, when a wonderful gay couple comes to them and says, we would like to get married in your church. And we can say, yes, let's plan that together. And so in a way, when the church locks itself up in these kinds of cycles of injustice for the sake of a gospel story, which I believe is not right, because it's just insufficiently radically inclusive in the way that I understand Jesus to be genuinely radically inclusive, then there's also a kind of deterrent that happens where the spaces themselves can become less and less appreciated. And when people wander in, they might, you know, really love the feeling of hundreds and hundreds of years of people being there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're interested in turning up on a Sunday morning. And I can understand why. And what I deeply yearn for is for those things to be put together more, because those buildings are always singing the song of God and creation and of human beings doing their best for God at any particular period or place. And in a way, they're our best advocates sometimes. You know, you go to Canterbury Cathedral and you think, God, this place is totally incredible. And it's got this amazing contemporary art installation right next to something that's from the 14th century. Isn't that incredible? Doesn't that make me want to think about my own human story in a new way? That's wonderful. But then there are also these spaces where the words that are heard are either incomprehensible and alienating or are just downright offensive and oppressive. And that really breaks my heart. It's hard.
Ayla, I'm not sure if you have heard about this, but here in Australia, there are examples in different parts of the country, actually, of small local churches with, you know, church buildings, having those buildings sold off in some cases to contribute to the redress fund owed to the victims of child sexual abuse for which churches and clergy have been culpable.
Wow.
It's not an abstract shift, is what I'm saying, is that actual buildings and their communities are being redefined in a way as non-sacred, in a sense, in order to address the disasters and wounds and I don't even really have words for it, the horrific abuses and injustices of the past that aren't really as past as we would all hope they are.
No.
And I guess with that, I wonder if whether there's a place for the opposite movement. I mean, you sound very optimistic that a building, even a religious building, can move people in the opposite direction towards a more open contemplation of precisely the faith that has been so complicit in so many things.
Yes.
I mean, do you really, is that your own experience?
Wow. First of all, you have just shared something with me, which is new to me. And you have moved this conversation into territory where I want to pause and honor and lament and recognize the deep damage and pain of that. I just want to make sure that that's clear and that that's said. And that the kind of lack of dignity in so many directions that those circumstances have led to is unspeakable, and yet it must be spoken about. And I really deeply hope that reparations of many kinds, I also think about the histories and legacies of enslaved peoples and the way that that's bound up in the resources which continue to be not shared properly. Right, that those conversations continue. That's really, really important.
I mean, here in Australia, those conversations in a colonial context are really still ahead of us, in my view. This whole reckoning is not over. It's barely begun in many cases, and it relates precisely to the built assets of the churches, which, as we've been saying, do you know have these many layers attached to them.
Yeah. And it makes me curious, too, about the desirability of these spaces, and also coming back to that sense of optimism about encounter with sacred space and how that can be in itself a real experience of hope, if not an outright experience of incomprehensible grace of healing in one way or another. And so the first thing I think is, and this a different version of this happens in the UK from time to time with church closure and with, you know, wondering what to do with heritage assets and what to do sometimes with contested cultural heritage, which is a whole very important zone. And one of the things that gives me hope in this is something called the Church's Conservation Trust, which is an absolutely fantastic charity. And they believe that churches are spaces that are open for all. They do this really cool thing called camping, where people can come and camp in churches. They do amazing family events of all kinds. And they reconfigure the place and the role of the church without deconsecrating it. So those spaces are still used in all sorts of different ways for Christian purposes, as well as for community purposes of many innovative kinds. And so I think that if something's going to happen where a congregation and a church community are no longer responsible for that space, then that doesn't have to be a completely lost opportunity for a community. One of the saddest things I ever saw was a church in Wales that was being used as a mattress store. And for whatever reason, there was just this, and it was a really sad little shop. And there was something about the conjunction of these things that really bothered me. And at the same time, you know, it's a convenient size and shape and someone has to sell mattresses somewhere. I kind of get that. But it felt incredibly sad to me that there was a space that had been built by people to worship God. And for whatever reason, that space and those people and that community had really drifted apart. It was what sometimes people call redundant. And that idea of redundancy is though you've kind of let someone go from a company feels really tough to me. Maybe there's something better that we can do with these spaces. And I worry, though I understand too, about what happens when the spaces themselves become emblems or symbols of a terrible past and terrible violence, rather than being opportunities to create spaces of really good, restorative, deep encounter with the only solution and the only source of our healing, who is, at least in my view, who is God and who is Jesus Christ. You know, like it's a huge, deep thing. And it makes me think of two books, which I just love and which I'd love to recommend. One is by Jerrell Robinson Brown, and it's called Black, Gay, Christian, Queer, The Church and the Famine of Grace. And the other is by Rennie Chow Choi, and it's called Ancestral Feeling, and it's about post-colonial experiences of churches and cathedrals, and in particular the Church of England, but Christianity more broadly. And she talks about heritage sites as being sites where all kinds of people have deep experiences, and she is concerned about a nationalistic and nostalgic colonial narrative sometimes, you know, constantly toxically pervading those spaces, so that there are so many assumptions made about whose space this is. And if we take the idea of sacred space seriously, I believe that those spaces, capitalistically or institutionally, of course, you know, a particular church belongs to a particular diocese and as a result can be bought and sold. But also, those spaces belong to God. To me, there's something liberating about the whole thing being gift, and that we enter into a kind of non-transactional gift exchange in a way of experiencing the transcendent. So it's about open-handed offering rather than a kind of possessive acquisitiveness. And that's a really hard circle to square, that things are both owned and not owned, if you like. But these churches, they are opportunities for encounter with the divine in a unique way. And they're also very useful spaces where people can come together and have a roof over their heads and experience something of hope, and also experience something of really positive facilities. I think, again, of homeless people who are right now, this minute, in and around central London, who know that when they come and they sit in the pews at St. Martin in the Fields, they will be safe and dry and warm, and they will be welcomed with dignity and care rather than rejected. And that's a precious thing.
When I was reading some of your writing on this theme of sacred architecture, I was arrested by a line where you say that architecture doesn't teach us what the sacred is, but it may touch it and draw others to it. But you mentioned that you have now turned to ordained ministry in the last few years, and I wonder how you see your role as a priest in that task of interpreting the holy, perhaps drawing people to the sacred. What's it like for you now to be, yeah, a priest with this sensitivity to art and particularly to architecture? What resonances do you see?
Oh, well, this is a real threshold time for me. So I'm glad you asked, because I am currently Amundsen Fellow in Art and Religion at the National Gallery. So in the gallery context, I spent a lot of time thinking about how religion and theology are important themes for people of all faiths and none. And I'm about to start a new job in July as associate rector at St. James's Piccadilly, a church not far from here, just down the street. And both of these buildings are utterly beautiful and exciting and made for very different purposes. And St. James's is a space where there's an incredible carving by Rindling Gibbons, a very famous early modern, I want to say woodsmith, like wordsmith. You know, he's someone who is so imaginative with the possibilities of wood in architectural context. And in that sculpture, at the top, there is an image of the pelican in piety. You may be familiar with this symbol. So it's a mother pelican who is feeding little chicks in a nest beneath her by pressing, vulning, sometimes it's called, by pressing her beak into her own breast to feed her chicks with her own blood. So it's a very powerful Eucharistic, Jesus-centered symbol for obvious reasons of sacrifice and love. And I love this idea of God as mother and God in nature. I think that's just, oh, it's a holy thing. And it's right above the altar. And so there's that real connection there too, between this symbol, which is a medieval symbol, and the way that it connects to what happens there every Sunday, every day. And when I first started to study art and architectural history, you know, over 20 years ago now, I had no idea that this was going to be my direction of travel. And yet I always felt something as an atheist as well. I didn't grow up Christian at all. I grew up atheist. I always felt something powerful when entering into sacred spaces of many religions that I couldn't name. I couldn't name it, but I was curious about it. And what I found is that sticking with this idea of nourishment and feeding, the buildings that I was in made me hungry. They really made me hungry spiritually and also made me hungry aesthetically. I drank them in. I fed on them. And I thought, I don't know how to interpret. I love that, the interpretation of holiness. I don't know how to interpret them historically, and I deeply desire to do so. And then slowly in my adulthood, I don't know how to interpret the love of God in action sacramentally, and my desire is to do so. And so these things have started to merge and blend together in ways that I can't comprehend really, but that I struggle and stumble my way towards as best I can day by day and Sunday by Sunday. And what I feel like I do a lot of the time, and this podcast for me feels like a really wonderful and privileged for me, joyful example of it, is to kind of stand on the bridge between being an art historian who loves to teach people and share with the general public aspects of altarpieces or impressionism from a theological point of view, while also being someone who dares to stand on what's sometimes called the borders of the holy, and to be alongside people in a way that might help them to see that the light of the whole of God's love for them in infinite blessedness is already within them. And actually there's nothing you can do, but there's also nothing that you need to do. That's grace in order to receive that. So there's something there in uncovering that which was already there that I feel is a really delightful, joyful commonality between spending time with art and spending time at the altar and sharing that with people. And there too, it's super collaborative. And so I hope that kind of helps as a sort of way of seeing what I think I'm doing, or at least what I'm trying to do as best I can with lots and lots of help.
Dr. Ayla Lapine is the Amundsen Fellow in Religion and Art at the National Gallery in London, and now an ordained Anglican priest as well, which is no small thing for a queer woman who grew up atheist. She's published academic books and essays, of course. There are further details on our website. But what I'd really recommend is a terrific online article she wrote exploring the way that architecture might interpret holiness to people. There's a link to that on the Soul Search homepage, so why not have a read? It's Meredith Lake here with you via podcast and on ABC Radio National. And from London, we're heading to Port Moresby now in Papua New Guinea. Adherents of the Baha'i faith there are constructing a house of worship. Zsa Agabi Granfa grew up in a Catholic family of Filipino heritage, but like her husband Saeed, she's now part of Port Moresby's Baha'i community. And I've got to ask, is that community very big?
Yeah, sure. So the Baha'i community in Papua New Guinea, it's essentially predominantly rural. There's approximately a range of around 60,000 people across the country. And it's primarily indigenous to Papua New Guinea. It's a vibrant community life, you know, and so consistent with what happens around the world in the Baha'i communities, you know, there's activities and community building activities that are done at the level of children in terms of children's education with young people and junior youth, we call them, youth and even adults, and trying to inspire a life that's not just about personal development and, you know, spiritual development, but also contributing to one's society.
Zsa, you obviously have experience of the Baha'i community in other places. You mentioned that you spent some time in Australia as well. Mm-hmm. Does the Baha'i community in PNG have, I guess, a flavour or a culture that reflects the huge diversity linguistically, tribally, of Papua New Guinea? After all, a country with something like 800 languages being spoken there.
So the Baha'i faith at its essence and in its core, the principles are, you know, about the oneness of religion, the oneness of God, the oneness of humanity. And that's not about uniformity. It's about celebrating our diversity, but then also recognizing that we are part of one whole family. So I guess in terms of the diversity that exists in Papua New Guinea, you know, where you've said, you know, there's more than 800 different languages, which is, from what I understand, you know, 12% of the world's languages effectively, which is spoken by roughly about 1,000 tribes across the country. The faith is something that brings people together and acknowledges and celebrates that diversity, but also brings people together in terms of how we work together, how we consult and collaborate together and work towards, you know, a unified humanity, not necessarily requiring us to be all the same, but just like a garden with many, many different kinds of flowers, we celebrate that difference. We celebrate the beauty of that, but recognize that we share the same root system and that we all actually are one family, and which, has some really fundamental implications of how we can view our progress, you know, as a human race, if you will.
You mentioned, Zsa, that the majority of the Baha'i community in Papua New Guinea is rural, although I understand there's a temple under construction at the moment not far from Port Moresby. So in the absence of a temple and perhaps in more rural areas, where do Baha'is worship?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing. So in terms of practice, people worship, in their homes, at the village or rural level. Sometimes they, you know, communities will construct a little dedicated space or a little hut, if you can imagine that, where it's usually quite humble and simple. And that's where maybe collective devotional sort of prayers can be said together. Yeah, like I guess you mentioned the house of worship that's being built. It's very much a national icon that's is basically a symbol of what's already happening across the country, where Baha'is and their friends, their family are coming together, and they're not necessarily all from the Baha'i community. We already know that a significant amount of people that come together for those devotional sort of gatherings are also from the wider community. So, the spaces can be quite flexible. So in terms of how Baha'is pray, it can be at home. Personal prayer is not restricted or restricted to just a temple, for example, or collective prayers, not necessarily restricted to a house of worship, but certainly a house of worship as a space is very distinct and has very special atmosphere in its own right.
I'd love to explore that a little bit more and learn about, I guess, the plans for this temple that's being built in Port Moresby. Saeed, could you just describe what the building is going to look like? I mean, I understand, and this is common to Baha'i temples, I think, it's going to have quite a large dome. Why is that?
I think the dominant form or the design concept, as you may have seen, it's that of weaving. And this concept was from the very beginning very well received by the national governing body of the Baha'i community here. And it did evolve and was refined over a long period. It was something like 18 months with the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'i community here. In terms of the dome, yes, I think most houses of worship represent a large dome. They're nine-sided. But apart from those two facts, I think you'll also see a lot of diversity in the forms and concepts behind them. So each is to also reflect the culture of the locality in which it's built.
I've seen an image of the planned temple, and the weaving is quite extraordinary. It kind of rises up all the way up to the top of the dome. It pointed in two directions when I looked at the picture. One, of course, to weaving as one of the most, you know, refined, practical and artistic, you know, pursuits of communities in Papua New Guinea. And also to a kind of a principle of, well, you mentioned it earlier, this kind of interweaving of different traditions into a kind of a common tapestry. Could you elaborate a bit on why weaving?
Yeah, it's a beautiful observation. The brief for the project called for a universally Papua New Guinean theme, which in the context of the many cultures here was a challenge. And I should also at this point mention that there are two architects involved, namely Henry Lape, a local architect, indigenous Papua New Guinean architect, and myself. And we really reflected on this theme of universality and actually independently came across this idea of this notion of weaving being a universally Papua New Guinean theme, being very beautiful in form and also having this conceptual strength of one way to look at it is that the individual strands are of a woven basket, for example, are in themselves relatively weak in comparison with the woven form, the woven basket, the woven bag or sail or wall or sculpture, which can be built out of it. So conceptually also this idea of weaving we thought had potential and strength.
Saeed, I noticed too that there are nine planned entrance canopies. Is nine a significant number? Just because I've noticed it recurring in other recent Baha'i temple designs, which have been taking place in other parts of the world in recent years. What's the significance of that number?
Mm-hmm. In the Baha'i faith, it represents comprehensiveness or culmination in a sense that it's the largest single digit before you have to start making numbers up of multiple digits and includes all the others. Is one aspect. Another is that the number nine is also the numerical value of the name Baha, which means glory, and from which the Baha'i faith derives, the name of the founder being Baha'u'llah.
Ja, you mentioned earlier this image of flowers in a garden, a kind of diversity in unity, which makes me wonder if there are landscaping plans for this temple as well. Is there an intention for a garden to be part of this new complex?
That's a great question, and I probably should flick that to Saeed.
Okay, so certainly there's quite a beautiful landscape component to the project and to most houses of worship. Originally, interestingly, the approach was to have a bare minimum landscape, which was to evolve through the involvement of the community over, let's say, 2 or 3 decades. So it would start off very small as a bare minimum, maybe in the immediate surroundings of the house of worship, and gradually work its way out as the capacity and resources allow. And currently, I would say we're somewhere in the middle where it was decided to actually go a little bit beyond the minimum. And I think in part it's because of the recognition of the significance of the landscaping in the experience of the visitor and the preparation, the transition from the hustle and bustle of the city and life in the city to a space which is, you could say, pure, silent for the most part, and yeah, quite a serene, reverent experience.
Well, I know the building is not yet complete. It might be a little way off at this point in time, but how will you and the Baha'i community in PNG use the building once it's finished? What is its purpose or its essence? What does it mean to the community, so to speak? Zha, perhaps you could answer that one.
Yeah, as I've mentioned before, the House of Worship is really, you know, a genuine national icon of unity, symbolizing and embodying, you know, the essential principles at the core of the Baha'i faith, which are the oneness of religion, the oneness of God, and the oneness of humanity. And, you know, we've touched on the incredible diversity of Papua New Guinea. And one aspect, I guess the success for this space or how this space is being envisaged to be used would be that it is a unifying space across that diversity, that it becomes a reverent place of prayer, that it's for meditation and reflection, regardless of their belief or non-belief or their age or their ethnicity or their gender, and that this kind of collective devotional character can then inspire those who have visited the House of Worship to live a life of rendering services for the betterment of humanity. So it's quite unique in that in the PNG context, the predominant belief is in the Christian faith. And so many people are very used to what happens, you know, in the church sort of structure of things. And so this concept of everyone being welcome, that there is no clergy, that there is no sermoning, there's no, you know, seeking of funds through, you know, the basket of giving funds or donating funds. It's really in its purest form a space that people can come together, pray, reflect, and be inspired to then render services to their community. And in the Pacific, we're really, really quite lucky. And it's very special that we have 4 houses of worship or 4 temples, if you will, in our region. You know, we have a local house of worship in Vanuatu. There's another continental one in Samoa. And of course, in PNG, we're building this national house of worship. And then Sydney, of course, as you'd be aware, has a house of worship, and where, you know, this kind of dynamic where it's served to inspire countless people to work towards noble aspirations has been happening for several decades.
My understanding is that there may be 2 general modes in which the space might be used. Mm-hmm. One being as a silent place for a personal prayer and reflection. And I would say for the vast majority of the time, this is how the space actually looks like. Just a very quiet space where the doors are open, where there may be a basket at the entrance, for example, containing the various holy scriptures or sacred scriptures from all of the faiths. And people are welcome to either take whichever book they feel comfortable to take and enter the space and reflect silently, meditate or pray. And the second mode, let's say, is more like organized devotional programs, which may comprise a Baha'i scripture or again be comprised of quotes and readings from the various faiths of the world. And I think we have examples of these kind of services that are held in the existing established houses of worship.
Is this building or will this space be sacred in some sense to each of you. And what kind of sacred space do you think it might be? Is it related to the kinds of practices that are taken up in that space, the prayer or the meditation that might occur, the devotional life of the community that uses it? Is it something to do with the kind of texts that are read? Or is there something about the space itself, perhaps its beauty, that suggests a sacredness? I mean, do you think of it as a sacred space, and how?
I suppose to answer that from a personal perspective, I consider beauty even a virtue. You know, it's a virtue that is actually in its own way has a spiritual significance. And all of these elements that you mentioned, you know, someone coming to sit or reflect and pray or reflect on sacred scripture, or listen to sacred scripture being read out by, you know, an individual, or, you know, the actual atmosphere that the surrounding gardens or the building itself, within the building itself, the interiors may provide, or whether it's the singing that might happen, the choral singing that may happen throughout the space. I think all of those elements combine and synthesize to create a space of beauty, and beauty in the sense of a genuine beauty, where I think my personal belief is that souls, each of us, if we consider ourselves souls, well, you know, we are born noble. We're noble beings, and our soul is naturally attracted to beauty. You know, I guess one could liken it to the sensation or feeling of reverence that we feel when we all watch a sunrise or a sunset. There's this innate spiritual element to beauty when it's a real sense of beauty. And I hope that, like, this space will be quite sacred and quite special for me personally. And I hope that it has the same kind of feeling for others, you know, especially when you contrast that to the common way that many people live, you know, busyness and, you know, being bombarded with content and technology and a lot of different things, which are not negative, but I think it's very healthy for us to have these spiritual pauses. This space will not only provide that at a personal level, but definitely at a collective level as well in Papua New Guinea. I think for those of us that live in PNG, or, you know, we see many challenges in our society here. And so hopefully this space will become one of these, like an oasis or a sanctuary where we can get past a lot of those challenges and come back and pause and feel inspiration that can help us in the rest of our sort of daily life or daily living.
One way in which the sacredness of the space is preserved, you could say, is that the nature of the worship within the walls of the house of worship is devotional in nature. So it's not, it's about prayer, either silent or out loud. It's the reading or chanting of the sacred scriptures in their purest form, to allow the worshippers within the space to reflect on those words, as opposed to the words of an individual at the end of the day, standing at the front at a pulpit and giving his or her interpretation of those words. So my understanding is that we've each been given ears to hear with, eyes to see with, a mind and a soul to understand with, and to connect with the very, like, infinitely deep and profound meanings enshrined within the sacred scriptures in particular. So there's a very big difference between listening to someone give his or her personal interpretation of these words and trying to derive individual meaning from the sacred scriptures.
So it's a shared space in which the individual derives meaning. I mean, what a fascinating concept. So just finally then, what's something that each of you are looking forward to as this building comes to its completion?
One aspect, of course, is at a very deeply personal level. I, like many people here in Papua New Guinea and in Port Moresby and even around the world, really look forward to being able to enter the space and to use the space as it's being envisaged, and to use that in a country that I've grown up in and, you know, that I've, you know, was born in, etc. And I think before we, you know, before we came back to PNG to be part of this project, really it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that I would have personally envisaged, that a Baha'i temple or a house of worship would be in PNG. So it's quite special in that connection. It has a lot of very sentimental value for me personally in that way. And I guess on another level, because I volunteer for the Baha'i community here with the Office of External Affairs, we've been through that office, you know, doing some work to try and raise awareness and understanding of what this space means, you know. And so we've had people at the national level, like, for example, the Cardinal and other very significant leadership of various churches and the Islamic community, the Imam, the Buddhist community, the Hindu community, and the Jewish community. We've had people come through and, you know, we've been talking to people in those communities about this space. And I really look forward to share this experience with those people. You know, in our conversations, for example, with the Cardinal, he's expressed that he looks forward to being able to read verses from the Bible in this space, for example. And so I think in a country where we feel a lot of the contention and a lot of the issues come up because people see differences all the time, you know, it's like a lot of othering. I think it'll be really lovely at a personal level to share a space with people that we've been talking to and connecting with, and for them to see and experience a space in this manner. So I also look forward to that aspect of it.
Sha Agabi Granfa, who volunteers with the Baha'i External Affairs Office in Port Moresby, alongside her husband, Saeed Granfa, who's one of the architects involved with the new House of Worship being built in Papua New Guinea. You can head to the Soul Search website for pictures of the building as it's being envisaged, and for another fascinating case study of what sacred architecture can be, you might have heard about a new mosque that opened recently in Punchbowl in southwestern Sydney. More than 20 years in the making, it's a severe concrete design that's been described as a masterpiece. But get this, the architect isn't Muslim, he's Greek Orthodox, and suggests that his background also helped to shape the mosque's appearance. It's an amazing building, and if you'd like to see it, you can head to ABC iView. There's an episode of Compass called The Architect and the Mosque, and it tells the whole story. For now, though, thanks to producers Rowan Salmond and Nadiat El-Ghouli for producing this episode of Soul Search, and to RN's Anne-Marie de Bettencourt for sound engineering. I'm Meredith Lake. Thanks so much for joining me. And next time, a conversation about reconciliation with Dr. Anne Patel-Gray. She was the first Indigenous Australian to be awarded a doctorate in theology back in the 1990s, and she's now a globally recognised expert on Black theology. I hope you can join us with the ABC Listen app and right here on RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.